morning, Mets fans. Welcome back to Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World Series. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And Chris, we have the best timing in the world. Last week, we recorded this before a doubleheader in which the Mets got thoroughly embarrassed, losing 21-3, and then, was it 6-0 in the second game, I think?
That sounds right.
Something like that, after having lost 7-0 the night before. However, since that day, since we released the last podcast, not recorded, but released the last podcast, the Mets are 5-1 over the last six games. They are playing some, you know, real low-hanging competition here. There is not a lot of hopeful baseball to be played between teams like the Pirates and the Cardinals. So taking all of that into consideration, the Mets are only seven games back in the wild card, which, look, they're not going for that, right? That is not their goal. But I think a good conversation to start with is, are they tanking enough? If the goal of selling off players was to restock for next year, a top six draft pick would certainly help that. Or restock for the future, not just for next year, but restock for the future. A top six draft pick would certainly help that. And so are the Mets tanking hard enough? And I guess, is there any reason for them to still be looking at the wild card standings?
Yeah, those are the two big things right now, right? They're very much in between. Before things really went south, Greg Prince wrote a really good piece about sort of the in-between state of the Mets, I think, back in July over at Faith and Fear and Flushing. And this just feels like a different, a more intense sort of version of that. When you look at the lineups and who they're putting out there as their starting pitchers, I think they're certainly trying to tank. You're seeing maybe some more days off for guys who typically wouldn't take any. They're rolling out spring training lineups most days, and somehow it's just kind of working right now. But I don't know how they could try harder to tank. And it's
that
very
was gonna be my question. Yes.
Aside from doing things that would really piss off the players who you want to stick around. You're not going to bench Lindor and Alonso for a week just to lose games because, you can only get so negative before you start to maybe have a negative effect on next year and, the future beyond that.
I think there could be a grievance brought against you for actions like that.
Right. Yeah. So looking at, and this has been my resource for this, I'm just going to assume it's accurate, tankathon.com. Not something I've typically done, but baseball has this draft lottery that I'm not nearly as invested in sort of all the machinations of the NFL and the NBA. So maybe their draft lotteries work exactly the same way. Maybe I should know that, but quite frankly, I just don't care.
Same.
So I watch football, but I kind of learn who the Giants rookies are like in week one. There's plenty of time to catch up. Assuming this site is accurate, and I have no reason to think it's not, the Mets have a lot of work to do if they want to get into that top six. I know the Nationals have something that I think that they're going to be bumped out of it no matter what, based on a lot of the details of all these things. As disappointing as the Mets have been, I think it's also easy for people to forget how bad the teams below them in the standings still are.
I was just going to make that exact point. So there are four teams in baseball that haven't won 50 games yet.
Yeah.
And the Mets have only won 57, but the A's have won 34 games. 34 games.
Yeah.
You know, the A's, the Royals, the White Sox, and the Rockies are easily the four worst teams in baseball. And the way that the draft lottery works, if I'm not mistaken, we've talked about this before on the show, is that there are, like, every team with a bottom 10 record is given more, or I guess, depending how bad your record is, you're given more balls in the draft lottery machine or whatever it is. And right. So the worst records have the best chance of pulling a top six draft pick. The top six are protected no matter if you went over the luxury tax threshold or not. Beyond that, you would lose 10 places before your first pick. So yes, there is a lot to be said for tanking, but like you were saying, I mean, how do you tank harder? You know, look, I am one of the internet's top five Joey Lucchese stans, so I am not at all surprised that he threw a great game last night. But he has not been great for the Mets this year. They're rolling out guys that should not be putting up great starts, and yet some of them are working out, right? No one expected the DJ Stewart power show that we've gotten over the last couple of weeks. You know, look, they're starting fucking Jonathan Aruiz, or however you pronounce his name. I messed that up, I think, but they are putting out joke lineups, and they are beating teams that are worse than them, I guess. Now here's where it gets interesting, and this is a classic throwback to Amazing Avenue Audio we haven't done in a while. But I'm looking at the schedule. Okay, so after the Cardinals, the Mets play the Braves in Atlanta. They're probably going to lose by 40 runs over that. Then they have the series at home against the Angels. And the Angels are, I guess, a slightly better team record-wise. They are 60-63 at the time of recording. The Mets are 57-66. So they're a better team than that. But the Angels just find ways to lose. I don't know if you saw this last night, Chris. Did you see that Ohtani hit a grand slam yesterday and the Angels turned a triple play and they still lost to the Rays yesterday?
I did not. I did not see all of those specifics. But
yeah.
Yeah, that team, as much as we might feel cursed as Mets fans, I don't know, man. I'm not one to get into that, but it feels like the Angels are. Just
yes.
Like,
yes.
I don't understand. I understand that it takes more than two all-time great players to make a team good, but I really don't understand how they're in the spot they're in. As I look at the standings, can we just enjoy a brief moment of schadenfreude that the Yankees are not only also seven games out of the third wild card in their league, but they are also under 500.
Yes.
Which, if Judge were out, I mean, the time he missed obviously had a huge effect on their season. But if Judge were still out, that wouldn't surprise me so much.
Right.
But there was no, like, nothing's gone right.
No.
Just what a year for New York baseball.
Yeah. But after the Angels, the Mets are going to play a series of teams that should destroy them. They're playing the Rangers, who are in a playoff position. They are playing the Mariners, who are in a playoff position. They have two against the Nationals. That'll be whatever. The Twins are in a playoff position. The Diamondbacks are in a playoff position. The Reds are in a playoff position. The Marlins are almost in a playoff position. The Phillies are in a playoff position. And then it's Marlins and Phillies again to the end of the season. So, you know, I think that even if it seems like right now the Mets are not tanking all that hard and there's a chance that they sniff at the wild card still, I think if you look at September specifically, there are only two games in September, which is against the Nationals, where they are playing a team that is not cannot reasonably expect to either make the playoffs or fall one position short of making the playoffs.
Yeah, that's true. I will say, slight disclaimer for the Twins, they play in like a AAA division, but...
That's fair.
Yeah. It's been at least a little bit comforting. It's never comforting that the Braves are good, but seeing teams like the Yankees and Twins also get destroyed by them at various points this year,
yes,
is a nice reminder that it's not just us.
Right, exactly, yes.
And Yeah, I don't know. But your overall point is a good one. It would be really nice. I mean, the Phillies are probably safe, but they're not so far up. Like in the American League, the Baltimore-Tampa Bay, you know, whoever doesn't win that division is going to make the playoffs. Yes. You know, there's a real gap between those two teams and the wild card teams in the AL. It would be a lot of fun if the Astros failed. And, like, I'm not hating on Verlander or anything by saying that, but just for a change, it would be fun if it was the Mariners and the Blue Jays instead of,
I love that, yes,
you know, the Astros and one of those two teams.
If it was, if the playoffs had Baltimore, Tampa, and Toronto in it, the collective Yankee and Red Sox dickhead fans I know would lose their minds. So that is reason enough to root for that.
There you go. Yeah, there's a point in some of the time that we spent in Boston this summer where a family friend, like, you get along great and whatever, but just randomly decided to kind of like shit on the Mets. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was like, yeah, but unlike the Red Sox, they're not in last place. But I don't even have a dislike of the Red Sox. Like, I love them in my park. And
You grew up in no man's land between the two fan bases, whereas I grew up firmly in an anti-Boston area. But doesn't really bother me. What bothers me, there's one guy, and he's never going to hear this, so I'm still not going to say his name just in case he does, which is that he is somebody who every year is like, oh, I can't believe how bad things are for the Red Sox. We're cursed. And I'm like, you fuckers have won so many World Series in the last 15 years. Shut your mouth.
Yeah. No, a friend of mine who's a Mets fan has made that point that he, at least among Red Sox fans that he knows, mm-hmm. that there's still this, like, carrying the vibe of the curse, right?
Yep.
Despite having, I don't know, maybe the most successful franchise in this century so far.
Yeah, probably.
In terms of titles, right? Yeah. Has anybody won as many as them? I don't think so.
I don't believe so. I'm looking this up, so you could talk.
Yeah. Well, it would be a lot of fun if the playoffs were mixed up a little bit in that sense. But it would also be a lot of fun if the Mets could spoil a Marlins season at the end.
Yes.
You know, the Marlins didn't come in with expectations this year. They haven't been leading the division and then collapsing at the end and all that, but I don't know. I'd still like to send them packing in late September.
Yes.
Just because, you know, I can vividly remember the end of the 2007 season.
Oh, yeah. The Red Sox have won 4 World Series this century. The San Francisco Giants have won 3. Yankees have won 2. Yeah. Astros have won 2.
Wait, who were the Astros and who were 2?
Yankees.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, since the last dynasty
ended in 2000. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cardinals have won 2 also. Forgot about that.
Oh, yeah. The one stands out, obviously.
Yes.
The other one, not so memorable.
No. Although the Mets were in the playoffs in that year as well. No, I'm sorry. No, they weren't. Nope. I read that wrong. Nope, not at all. 2011 was a dark season for the Mets. Forget I said anything.
Yeah, in doing Mets Morning News yesterday on Amazing Avenue, I went back and, just pulled the this date in Mets history. Mm-hmm. And I think I made a mistake and pulled the wrong date first and then corrected it. But that particular this date in Mets history had Pat Mish. Now, it was his birthday. That's, you know, he was mentioned in there. But at first, I see Pat M, and I think Mahomes, of course.
Sure.
But then my brain realized, well, that photo is definitely not Pat Mahomes. But then Pat Mish, I remembered the name, but when I went to Baseball Reference to look him up, off the top of your head, roughly, like, what era of the Mets, like, what decade did he play for the Mets in your memory?
So I have this memory of him wearing the Snow White uniforms, and I feel like that was the aughts. I'm going to say Pat Mish played for the Mets from 2009 to 2011.
Oh, damn. That's that might be exact.
Really? I just that was a total guess.
Yeah, yeah, it's exact. He got traded to the Mets in 2009 by the Giants. And played through 2011, and that was his last year in the majors.
I'm going to guess he made no more than like 15 starts for the Mets, 16 starts for the Mets with some bullpen appearances.
Yeah, Jesus, man. 13 starts.
This is all guessing. This is no talent. I'm just putting it out there.
13 starts and roughly 40 bullpen appearances.
Wow.
And he was like league average for 2009 and 10 as a member of the Mets by ERA plus. And then he got rocked in like a handful of innings in 2011, and that was that.
I mean, that's that tracks, right?
Totally. But that to me, despite you getting that like almost scary how on the nose that was, that for whatever reason, Pat Mish could have been like a 2002 Met, right?
Sure.
Like I was pretty confident he wasn't from the 90s, but aside from like that, I was shocked when I saw when he played for them.
Well, like I don't know if this is the same for you. Like I could tell you very specific members of the 06 and 15 rosters because we were poring over those so much. But like I know Marlon Byrd was a Met. I remember Marlon Byrd as a Met. Was it 09? Was it 13? I couldn't tell you that at this point. Like those are the things, those guys that were Mets briefly or that were minor Mets, I have no idea when they played for the team.
Yeah. It was 13.
Okay.
For him.
Yeah.
I just remember that it was one of those spring training sightings.
Yeah. He was the Tommy Pham of that year.
Yeah. And he looked in spring training. Like he was just locked in, hitting for like tons of power. And you know, for a 35-year-old to just look like he was, I don't know, like just that in the zone in spring training. I get that, you know, it wasn't like a big deal or anything, but he at the time it was his single season high in home runs by quite a few. He hit 24. The Mets traded him during that season because, as you said, yeah, that's the Tommy Pham of the year.
Yeah. He was traded for, was it? Dilson Herrera? Yes, Dilson Herrera and Vic Black. Look at that.
Oh, yeah.
I am on one.
Oh, yeah.
I got to play Immaculate Grid as soon as we're done because I am remembering some guys today.
Yeah. Big Black, man. Yeah, this is what we have the podcast about now, by the way, yes. Everybody. But Vic Black was, like, in my time, and obviously the pandemic threw it off. We had that very brief trip down to spring training, and then the pandemic hit hard, and I just haven't made it back since. And I don't know, for a variety of reasons, I don't know if or when that'll happen again. But during my like 7 or 8 year stretch of going to every spring training for a few days and taking a bunch of photos and being out in the backfields and all that stuff, nobody's ever been rude. I mean, Rafael Montero gave like the death stare into the camera that one time.
I remember that. Yeah.
Still one of my favorite photos. But very few guys have gone out of their way to just be polite, and Vic Black was one of them. Dylan G was another. You know, Dom Smith was like super duper like warm and friendly as like an 18-year-old.
And then do you remember the time we were there together? Dom Smith, he was walking down the dugout and he gave like the aloha symbol with his hand.
Yeah,
and you didn't get the photo. He did it again as you get the photo. So you know.
Well, yeah, he did it, and I was like, oh no, and then he just repeated the I wish he were doing better.
Me too. Yeah.
You know, you can't get attached to everybody to the point that you want them to all be Mets for their whole careers. But, always just seemed like a pretty decent person.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And this year with the Nationals looks pretty much like what he looked like for the last 2 years with the Mets.
Yeah, exactly. So. So before we run out of time this morning, we got to talk about the fact that Ronnie Mauricio is still not in the major leagues. This is a question we've asked a few times now, but it seems a little bit more relevant today because Mark Vientos is on the injured list. And so it seems like there is, I mean, look, there was a place for him on the roster no matter what, because this team is trying to lose. So play him, let him start for all I care. Start a pitcher for all I care. Like, you're trying to see what this guy can do. And I'm joking with the pitching, obviously, but you know, that doesn't matter where you play him, because you're trying to evaluate whether he has major league stuff or not. He needs to get at bats. He needs to play in the field. So is the fact that he's not called up, is that because they're afraid that he's that terrible, that he's going to be sub Mark Vientos this year, that he's going to be sub, you know, insert quad A player here? Or do they feel like he is starting to make progress and they don't want to mess with that progress? Like, what's the vibe that you get from the Mets and why they're not bringing him up?
I wish I had a little more time to get up to Syracuse and see him this year to have, I don't know, just a little more insight into this. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if it's, I mean, we've talked about it recently, the fact that they're not going to like hide anything if they are trying to protect him as a trade chip by not calling him up. So yeah, is it, do they think he legitimately just isn't ready and that it would be bad for him to do, or are they still like big time believers and they're holding out on service time because they think he's going to break out next year in some kind of way? I don't know.
What's hard to figure out here is if they think he's bad and he's not going to do anything, then they're balancing a really precarious line. They're walking a really precarious line, rather, which is like, do you then, if you're trying to tank, does he help you tank?
Right.
And you call him, or do you want to fleece some other team into trading for him this offseason? And so you're keeping him down to keep the inflated AAA numbers looking better and get rid of him that way.
Right. And now, like, I know with him, people have pointed out that what he's hitting is basically league average, which is kind of wild that, you know, the International League of AAA is not typically, you know, the Pacific Coast League is the one that's known as the hitter's haven.
Right.
But league average, currently hitting 286, 337, 44. That's much higher than the league average at the major league level.
Right.
Or probably in Double A right now. But yeah, I mean, the power and speed combo is there. Presumably he's at 19 home runs now. Presumably he'll hit a few more. You know, his walk rate's above his career norms in the minors. His strikeout rate is the best it's been since he was in, you know, rookie ball. Mm-hmm. I don't quite get it. Like, I know a lot of people are down on him, but I don't understand how he hasn't earned a look. Like, what part of his game isn't in line with what you're asking of him, right? I mean, maybe it's his defense, right? He played shortstop a lot. Obviously, they've been moving him around, and he's had time at second base, time at third base. But, you know, what more do you want out of him to give him a look? Does he have to hit like 350, you know, 350, 400 with a like 600 slugging?
Right.
You know, Alvarez and Vientos definitely had better AAA numbers than him in their time there this year. And Beatty has too. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Yeah, I just don't know.
Yeah.
If they're waiting forever to find his perfect defensive position, then he might never get called up.
Right. Yeah. And I can't imagine that. I can't imagine that there is. If we're asking the question, are they holding him back to increase his trade value? Then every major league office in the country knows that also, right? Like, they're not fooling anybody by keeping him down there. I guess the only thing you could say is that they are not necessarily, like, they're not, you know, it's better to be thought of a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt, right? Like, they're telling people might still think he's going to be a bust, but they're not giving him the evidence to prove he's going to be a bust. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Maybe that's the way it is. I don't know. It's strange. I don't really understand it. But it's a story we can talk about every week for the rest of the season. So thank you, Mets, because we need stuff to talk about, or else we get into Vic Black and Pat Mish territory every week. Anyway, Chris, what is your music recommendation for this week?
So last night I had the pleasure, and I've been very fortunate to have seen George Clinton live, I'm going to say at least a dozen times. I do track these things. I've fallen behind a little bit, but I should catch up. But to be able to see somebody that legendary in music that often in later decades of their career is something I do not take for granted. And the man's 82. He's still up there doing it. And he looks just as spry as he did when he was 70, which is just wild. So in appreciation of him, looking back at our music pick history, aside from the week where we both picked Maggot Brain by Funkadelic, without knowing, but, you know, on its 50th anniversary.
We don't discuss this beforehand, so this is always a surprise.
But aside from that, there has not been another George Clinton album pick. And I feel like overall I lean a little more Funkadelic in terms of just where my favorite stuff lies, but a huge album, not just in my personal experience of getting into his music with both bands, but really in the history of music and certainly up there is, you know, maybe the greatest, or if not in the top five for funk records, Mothership Connection by Parliament. It's one of those, like, I remember getting it on CD, and for me that was a huge piece of how I got into a lot of music. My CD collection is probably not going to be on display anymore, but I'm not getting rid of it either.
Right.
You know, it was always very important to me to actually get something. You know, I'd been through the Napster era and it's, you know, all the other apps that were available to download music of varying, like, qualities in terms of MP3 bitrate and everything. So to get an actual CD and a proper listen at high quality on, like, my Discman, or, you know, even just ripping it to the computer myself, and getting that level of, like, listening to what was intended, that was always important. And I distinctly remember getting the CD, and, you know, just playing the hell out of it. And, you know, at the show, I heard a couple of people in conversation at one point, and one person had said to the person they were with, like, oh, I don't know any of his songs. Like, they were going in totally fresh, and I didn't want to interject, but in my head, I'm like, well, you do, you just don't know it. You know, so you have, whether or not you've ever heard this record, you have probably heard a couple songs off of it. And if somehow you've avoided all of that all this time, then you are in for a treat. But this was definitely a big starting point for me with that half of George Clinton's catalog. And, you know, opening with P-Funk Wants to Get Funked Up is just, I don't know, that's a perfect summary of the band.
Yeah.
Just seven and a half minutes of fun, and there's a lot of fun in that band. I also somehow started but didn't finish George Clinton's book, and I need to correct that because
I didn't even know he had everything, a book, actually.
Yeah, everything I read in it was gold. But yeah, his autobiography. So yeah, but with that Parliament mothership connection, and man, what a cover too, right?
Yes.
Like it's so often like sci-fi imagery is associated with, or I'd say it's more rare that it's associated with like black artists, but there is a ton of it in the history of P-Funk.
Yes. I actually saw the mothership at the African American History Museum in Washington last year or 2 years ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
They have it there. It's incredible. The original one from the tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. Well, that's a great pick, Chris, obviously. So earlier this week, I was doing some sort of busy work I needed to do around the house. And so I put on a documentary I've been meaning to watch for a little while now. It is the Alex Winter, a.k.a. Bill from Bill and Ted, directed documentary called Zappa, about the life of Frank Zappa. And it's a very good documentary. It's about 2 hours long, and it doesn't really talk about his music that much, which is an odd thing to say about a documentary about a musician, but Zappa is such a character and has such a particular way of doing things that it's the only way to do a 2 hour documentary is to not like dig into all the different variations in music. He did talk about sort of some general stuff. Some of the early music gets more of a discussion, and the last thing he did during his life, The Yellow Shark, gets a little more discussion. But for the most part, it's just about the man's life and all of that. And it set me on a big Zappa binge this week, listening to stuff. I've heard every Zappa record, I believe, at least once. I'm actually planning on doing next year, maybe like one a week, really digging in and sort of doing a Zappa year thing because I love Frank Zappa. But I was thinking about it this week, and my favorite Frank Zappa record, and it's not even close, is Apostrophe. This is my favorite era of Zappa. He still has percussionist Ruth Underwood playing with him, who is my absolute favorite Zappa side person. Ruth Underwood is an insanely great mallets player, vibraphone, marimba, stuff like that. This has Jean-Luc Ponty and Don Sugarcane Harris on violin, Napoleon Murphy Brock on saxophone, Ian Underwood on sax also. Just some amazing stuff. There is the song Apostrophe itself has Jack Bruce from Cream on bass and Jim Gordon of Derek and the Dominoes on drums. Jim Gordon, who would later kill his mother with a hammer, but that's a fucked up story for a different day. It's just, it is the best instrumental stuff Zappa ever did. I am never as big of a fan of Zappa's lyrics as I am his music. I know that a lot of his music is sort of known for its lyrics, both like silly and sometimes controversial lyrics. But that stuff, I have to be in the mood to laugh at that sort of stuff. I never have to be in a mood to just appreciate the man's melodic gifts and the way he constructed songs and all of that. So the first side of this record is a concept that's like a story about someone called Nanook, which is the name of an Inuit person in the famous movie Nanook of the North. But this is not really that story. It's like a fake story about people, about this character. And it involves him. He goes to a church and he has pancakes there and he meets a priest. And it's a whole thing. It makes no sense, really. And again, the lyrics to me don't really matter. The amazing percussion in St. Alfonso's Pancake Breakfast is, I mean, just some of the best, some of my favorite recorded music of all time. The instrumental Apostrophe is incredible. Uncle Remus is a great song that sort of deals with both like race and class in a really interesting way for Zappa that he would not really return to that much. But yeah. I don't know if anyone listening to this needs an introduction to Frank Zappa, but this is what if anyone's ever Zappa curious, I say, listen to this. Try not to get too hung up on the lyrics about dog piss and just take in the music because it's awesome. That's my pick. Apostrophe from 74 by Frank Zappa. And thank you all so much for listening. We appreciate it. Who knows what the Mets are going to do next week, because we didn't expect them to do this week. So it's going to be an interesting time to be a Mets fan. We're happy you're here with us. Thank you again for listening. Chris is on social media at Chris McShane. I am on social media at Brian Intinep. Go to patreon.com/homerunapplesauce to support this podcast directly. And until next time, let's go Mets.